big thaw is happening, and the strength in numbers on so many fronts is just beyond encouraging. From a dwindling of about 1,000 bison in 1900 to the approximate 400,000 in the U.S. today, we have about 2,000 private ranches and farms, ranchers and farmers, to thank. Taylor Collins with Rome Ranch is one who, after selling a regen-based meat snack company, became a first-generation rancher to keep a focus where he felt made the most sense. Stewardship, great food, great community, and heart. We also welcome Dr. Carla R.M. Portugal, with a background in environmental engineering and ecological scientific research. She consults worldwide on the soil food web method for quickly regrowing the soil around the world. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for March 2025. Grab your earbuds and maybe even a shovel this time of year, and let's dig in. When did becoming a first-generation rancher-farmer come into view for you? Was it before, during, or after you having Epic Meat Snack Company, or was it after?
You know, the seed was sowed during our experience and our time spent growing the Epic Company. We were pretty hands-on, and so we visited all of our suppliers and verified that they were practicing regenerative agriculture techniques, and we wanted to get our hands on the soil and be in some form of an intimate relationship with the actual land stewards, be on a first name basis, know their children, know their family history, understand the context in which they operated. And when we would go out to these farms, I mean, it was just so life affirming. We were born and raised in Austin, Texas, so we'd never had exposure to this agrarian lifestyle. But I tell you what, it changed our trajectory. When we would visit these ranches, it was just a dream to, if one day we could double down on our mission, which is to grow these regenerative supply chains and connect consumers back to the source of their nourishment, if we could ever walk the walk and manage land ourselves, that would be a really amazing opportunity and a high calling. And we were fortunate enough to have Epic be purchased by General Mills, and with the proceeds from that transaction, we bought a ranch, just not really knowing exactly what we were doing, but it just felt like there was no other way for us to celebrate and to grow our family moving forward.
Tell us about the land you purchased that became Rome Ranch, and what were the previous owners doing with that land? So what were you coming into?
Sure. Yeah. Rome Ranch is located in the heart of the Texas Hill Country. We're right outside of a little town called Fredericksburg, and it's an hour from Austin, an hour from San Antonio. It's a nice central location, and we are managing 900 acres in Mother Nature's image. When we purchased the ranch a little over 8 years ago, it was highly degraded. And when I say degraded, you have to think of very harsh industrial chemical agriculture, which is how most food is produced globally.
Sure.
And the way that food was grown here was very extractive in nature, to where the fields would have been plowed 2 to 3 times a year, releasing carbon into the atmosphere, destroying the microbiome of the soil, intensive chemical applications of herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, and then, of course, chemical fertilizers were required to grow food. And so when we had purchased the land, that had been happening for over 80 years. And the natural resource, the fertility of this land had been all but lost. We acquired a land barren, and what we would imagine is common day kind of desertification was happening in this semi-brittle environment, to where it was bare soil as far as the eye can see, and the water cycle was broken, the energy cycle was broken. We couldn't find much worse off land in the Texas Hill Country, and that was really exciting for us because we could show, we could demonstrate
beautiful
these regenerative principles, these techniques, and demonstrate Mother Nature's capacity for healing and forgiveness, which thankfully far exceeds our own species' tendency for destruction.
Yes, certainly. And were you looking specifically for a property to have bison steward the land, or did the land itself express that to you?
Oh, I'd say a little bit of both. You know, bison has just always been this fascinating animal. They're the largest native ruminant animals in North America, and they're keystone species. And so by keystone species, that means they disproportionately create a positive impact on the ecosystem. They're the architects of the most fertile food systems that our country has been extracting our monoculture industrial food system from for generations. And so for us, it just made tons of sense to put this keystone native species back into the ecosystem which it co-evolved. You know, as far as asking the land what it needed, what it wanted, it felt like there was certainly a welcome reception and some kind of rejoice and celebration from nature, because when we put the bison back on the land, I mean, it was instantly this energetic exchange that was palpable, and new species started showing up immediately. Mm. The bison started calling in different birds and insects, and water was starting to infiltrate, so rainfall was effectively being captured for the first time in over 80 years. And so the whole ecosystem was kickstarted by the bison herd, and I feel like the land exhaled this sigh of relief once the herd was introduced back to their, you know, native ecology.
That's so amazing. It's so beautiful. And I'm wondering, since you are an Austinite and a Texan by birth, were you a Charlie Goodnight romanticizer at all?
He's a legend for sure. If I could go back in time and have dinner with, you know, a historical figure, I might pick him.
Yeah.
And so certainly reverence and admiration for Charles Goodnight. We were lucky enough to acquire one bull from the Charles Goodnight herd.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
Yeah, technically, the state of Texas is property, but just the most unbelievable sire breeding bull who just blessed this land with his Southern Plains Goodnight genetics and has really helped change our breeding program here.
So why just one?
They are hard to come by.
Okay.
The state of Texas will auction off animals from Cap Rock Canyon State Park maybe once a year on a good year. Some years they hold animals back, just ebbs and flows with the breeding cycles there. And it's very competitive to get a breeding bull from that herd.
I can imagine.
Because it's such a special niche genetic lineage. When the Southern Plains herd was decimated, there was less than 30 animals.
Oh, wow.
30 true Texas bison left on the planet. And so to reintroduce those genetics back into what's primarily a Northern Plains bison herd is really special.
Boy, I can imagine that was a happy day when you got that bison. So how did you educate yourself for purchasing bison stock, and what was key there for you?
Good question. I mean, most of our heroes and people that we look up to and learn from in the regenerative agriculture community, they're not raising bison, they're raising beef cows.
Right.
But oddly enough, when you explore their philosophy on how they co-create with their cattle, the first thing they'll tell you is, we use our cattle to emulate how bison behaves in the wild. And so we thought, well, let's just use bison to emulate how bison want to express themselves at their highest potential.
What a great idea.
And so we it made so much sense. So we had this framework in this context of, hey, bison have co-evolved to move. And they were hunted by apex predators, bears, wolves, mountain lions, panthers. I mean, even in central Texas. And so they would never stay in one location too long,
right,
or they'd be predisposed to predator ambush. So taking cues like that from how the bison co-evolved in these landscapes and doing our best as human managers to create the conditions which they can express their own life-affirming energy and give that back to the landscape. So things like moving the bison regularly, allocating sufficient rest in between grazing, having smaller paddocks so where you get more uniform grazing, cycling manure very uniformly. I mean, things like this, it's just what these animals instinctively want to do in the wild.
Of course.
And yeah. Those are our job to kind of let them take the lead on this delicate dance.
Right. Yes. And reading on your website of Rome Ranch, I saw that selling stock bison, you said they're 100% grass-fed and finished. And all of a sudden, it just felt like the burning of a rainforest to feed a buffalo anything except the grasses that grow in the wild. I just got really sad for a moment thinking about a grain-fed bison or buffalo. It was more than I could handle.
It's crazy. Consumers buy bison at the grocery store or at a restaurant. They instinctively imagine North American iconic bison, the national mammal of the United States. They visualize it eating grass on a prairie ecosystem. And when we started Epic, so, you know, we're going back like 10, 12 years ago, only about 8 to 6% of the entire bison herd on the planet was finished with grass and fed grass. And at that point in time, 92% of all bison were fed grain at the end of their life, which was wild. I mean, it was a desecration in our minds.
And yes, so totally.
Yeah, we've been working hard to converting that supply chain. And through our work now at Force of Nature, we're able to really amplify that and push towards that grass-fed model. I mean, it's how the system evolved, and it's how the animal was designed by a creator to return that net positive impact back on the ecosystem. So
right.
It doesn't make sense to feed it grain. It makes them sick. It makes the meat nutrition less. The whole capacity to carry energy and light is diminished significantly in the animal.
Yeah. Well, can you run us through a timeline from your initial bison purchase? How many, along with that number one from Charlie Goodnight, and how much pasture was ready to what it is today?
Sure. Our first herd was 30 animals that we purchased from the Nature Conservancy Tallgrass Prairie in Oklahoma.
And what year was this?
This would have been 2017.
Okay.
And then shortly after, we purchased another 30 animals from the Dakotas. And these were all yearling heifers, females that hadn't bred yet. They were pretty small. They weren't mature enough to breed. Introduced them to the property. We asked them to do some pretty challenging work, which was to kickstart a broken ecosystem. You know, we had 450 acres of previous farm fields. And so it was bare soil. And we had to get the animals on that bare soil. So we purchased hay, rolled out hay, which hay is carbon. It's light energy in a particle form. We rolled out that hay to cover bare soil and then had the bison graze that simultaneously. So what they would eat, they would ingest it, they would inoculate it with their own microbiome. It would come out the other end as fertility for the soil to kickstart the soil food web. And then the forage, the hay that they didn't eat, they would trample, which was integrating carbon and particle light energy back into the soil food web. And it was hard work, and it was a lot to ask for them to do, but there was this trust and this faith that we kind of built with the herd to invest energy and resources into this rebuilding phase. The goal still today is cover bare soil, because you're just missing this opportunity to capture sunlight, to sequester carbon, to feed your wildlife, feed your livestock. And the bison, gratefully, I mean, they're like Mother Nature's perfect creation. I mean, man can't come up with a better technology for disturbing soil in a way that helps promote more growth. And so we're talking about like the hoofs of the animals are spade shaped. When they walk, they chip away and they break up capped, hardened topsoil, which allows rainfall to infiltrate. It allows dormant seeds to germinate and express themselves. We kind of talked about the inoculation from their manure. They also wallow, so they roll around in the pasture and collect seeds on their back. And every time they're stepping, they're moving seeds, promoting biodiversity. Their hoofs, when you look at a bison hoof, I mean, there's probably 800 to 1,000 seeds in each hoof. So every time that animal steps, it's seeding for you. Again, this ecosystem architect that's just perfect in nature. You know, the bison have been doing what bison have been doing for hundreds of thousands of years, but we're just doing it in a modern context. I'd say the first 3 years were incredibly challenging to cover bare soil, to reset the energy cycles of nature, the water cycle. But there was a hockey stick moment about year four where things really started to pick up. And so we're kind of getting this energetic vortex that's expanding upward and outward, and it's growing, and the momentum is gaining, and it's the whole system working at a higher level and a higher degree. And that's where we are today. But we're nowhere near the potential of the land, and we're never going to reach it in my lifetime. We don't actually know the potential of our landscapes in the United States because they're so highly degraded, especially in the Southwest, because we live in, it's more of a semi-brittle environment.
Right.
Where it's boom or bust. We get rain and we get drought. We get freezing temperatures and then we get over 100 degrees for 2 months. It's incredibly challenging to kickstart Mother Nature's cycles when they're broken in that context. And so it takes time, but the results that we've observed in a short 8 years have been nothing shy of incredible. No one could have predicted how far along we've come in this short of a time.
Mm, that's so inspiring. And so what would you say about purchasing hay? How much less are you buying now than when you got started?
Oh, that's a wonderful comment. The hay, we don't want to get addicted to hay. Just like we don't want to get addicted to chemical inputs. And
right.
So the hay was to kickstart the system, and then we have hay on site for when we get in one of those drought cycles, which happens. This year, we really hadn't had to feed hay all winter long.
Oh, nice.
Which is pretty amazing. This is the first year that that's happened. Yeah, it's been a blessing. And we have an abundant amount of hay. We'll never cut hay here because, again, when I think of hay, I think of fertility. And so you don't want to just take your own fertility and sell that. So sell it to your neighbor, and then you're extracting and importing, and then they're importing that.
Right.
You want a closed-loop system in order for it to be truly regenerative. That's the goal. That's the direction we're headed to.
Nice.
But then we also have to be conscious of our herd size in the context of when we're in drought, we need to decrease the herd. And then when we're like, it's raining all year long, then the herd can grow.
Yes. Now, does restoring the biodiversity of native grass species and increasing density go hand in hand, or does focusing on one bring the other?
I'd say they go hand in hand. You know, one way to think about it is every square foot of soil in the Southwest could have up to 20,000 dormant seeds buried in it. Sometimes those seeds could be buried for hundreds of years waiting for the right context, the right ecological stimulus to express themselves and germinate. And that very well might be the microbiome of a bison defecating or urinating on that plant or on that ground. And so the higher density, the higher concentration you can get with your animals as they're grazing, you get this heightened sense of competition. It's not bad. It's almost like the dinner bell is ringing. If you don't eat, then it's going to be eaten by your neighbor. And so the salad bar opens up, the buffet is ready, and everyone's going to go for their favorite food. But you also might want to get your second and your third and your fourth favorite food because someone else is going to get it if you don't. So you get really good uniform grazing, which stimulates plant regrowth. And that's something that's really key in order to have plants express their highest potential. They co-evolved with these ruminant animals. So the bite of a bison, a pronghorn, an elk, a deer, or a cow, or a sheep, or a goat, that actually stimulates the roots of the plant to slough off some stored carbohydrates and sugars into the soil, which feeds the soil microbiome, but then it allows the blades of the grass or the forbs to regrow. And if you time the bite correctly and you time the rest appropriately, that plant will grow stronger with the presence of the animal. And so to really have that biodiversity, that wonderful biodiversity, really resilient, strong plants, the animals have to be a part of the equation. And they have to graze as animals co-evolve to graze these grasslands for millennia.
Yes. Have you done much cover crop planting?
We have. I was on our no-till drill this week. We do a cool season and a warm season blend. When we started, our soil fertility was so low. The desirable perennial native seeds, when we sowed those seeds, they didn't even recognize the soil as native soil. And so we took a different approach to where for the last 6 years, we've been seeding annuals. And these are annuals that do things like fix atmospheric nitrogen, cycle it into the soil, really focus on changing the structure of the soil through robust roots. Some have deep, deep tap roots that mine ancient earth minerals and bring them back up to the surface to where they can cycle those minerals back to the surface that might be lacking in the system. And so we planted a really diverse blend of cover crops, primarily annuals for the last 6 years, building soil fertility, feeding our animals, covering bare soil, kickstarting cycles of nature. And slowly we're starting to reintroduce the perennials that are the native, highly desirable plants. And we're starting to see those emerge and having success with those, which is really exciting.
Definitely. And it's just kind of mind-blowing that things have gotten so specific that you know, like, what are you planting when you're planting for something to go deep and mine those minerals that are deep in the soil?
Yeah, you want to plant something with a fat taproot. Some plants that are really good at that would be your forbs, things like mustard greens, things like plantains. You could do vetch.
Yes.
Even some peas, like winter peas, have really good, thick, deep root structures. You know, I've even heard of people planting things like radish and carrots, things that actually penetrate and open the porosity of the soil, too. Those are effective at changing the structure of the soil as well as pulling up really deep minerals. But the true hero species here are going to be your native grasses, things like Indian grass, switchgrass, little blue stem, big blue stem. These grasses have the potential for their root structures to go 8, 15 feet deep. And so when you get a grass working that hard and it's a perennial grass, holy smokes, you are starting to cycle some ancient earth minerals back to the superficial layers, which benefits the animal and it also benefits the soil food web in a way that's hard to even communicate or quantify.
Yes. Well, boy, just hearing you speak, Taylor, I want to thank you for being so diligent in your studies and in your actions. It's really a wonderful thing to hear about and to see, I'm sure. You have other livestock or other animals, right? You have pigs for pork and poultry. Is that true? Do you have others?
So we call ourselves a multi-species regenerative ranch, and we raise different animals at different times, but right now we're raising bison, we have heritage breed turkeys, we raise heritage breed laying ducks, we have geese, chicken, honeybee apiaries, and then truly we account for the hundreds of thousands of beating hearts on this ranch in the form of wildlife. They're part of the system as well, and we want to make sure there's a place at the dinner table for them. And so all of these animals, the complex interaction and relationship between them, we'll never understand, but we honor it and we welcome it. And so those are the primary species that call this land home right now.
And so what do you actively do with your pigs in relation to the bison?
So we're not raising pigs now, but when we did raise pigs, some of the property is the old farmland, which is a desertified landscape. But the other part of the property is more central Texas, hill country, kind of brush country. And so we use the pigs, we put them in the woods and allow them to agitate soil, to clear brush, to kind of open up a lower canopy level and to allow our hardwoods to have more resources. So we move all of our animals, but we move our pigs twice a week. And so not only were they cycling their own fertility through their manure, but they were using their snouts to gently till and turn the soil. And afterwards, we could come back and plant seeds right in that perfectly prepared garden bed that they created. And we would grow really neat mixes of wildflowers and forbs and grasses, which, you know, further fed wildlife and increased biodiversity, and then use the biological tool to very methodically do some land clearing of some undesirable, more invasive type shrubby species.
Right. Wow. Well, bison certainly are historically range roamers and covering huge landscapes. How do you figure that into your care of the bison?
Yeah. So on the 900 acres, we have around 80 pastures that we can move our animals to. And so we use high tensile fence. We use portable polyelectric fence with portable solar energizers to power the fence. And we've buried over 8 miles of water lines on the property. And so really the limitation on how we move our bison is up to our own imagination, what we can do. but we will move our bison in the growing season every 2 to 3 days. And when you move them through those 80 different paddocks over 2 to 3 days, you can calculate and compute the rest that you need depending on how the weather is, what season it is, and also sure. what your desired outcomes are. You know, in a perfect setting, in my highest dream, I would bring 3,000 bison on the ranch, hold them for 3 days, and then they would migrate and they'd move up to Colorado or northern New Mexico. And then they'd come back in 2 or 3 years. But the reality is you can't do that because there's a limitation in
sure.
you know, working bison, moving bison. And so we do our best to allow bare minimum 3 months of rest anywhere on the ranch. But in the areas that are a little bit more fragile, like riparian areas, we'll account for 6 to 8 months of rest and recovery between grazing.
Got it.
Well, so they're always moving.
Yes, yeah. Well, you and your partner, Katie, certainly have such a community spirit from the days when you had Epic and you were visiting where your product was coming from to today, where you have really opened up your ranch to the public. Tell us about some of the ways that you're doing that.
Yeah, you know, ultimately, we've never been at this historical moment in time where humans have been further disconnected from land, from the animals and the plants that sustain us. And we believe that that is by design, that large multinational food companies want that separation, because if you knew the environment and the context in which industrial meat was produced, you wouldn't want anything to do with it. And so our goal is to reorient people back to nature, back to appreciation and an opportunity to have reverence for this system that provides us with so many gifts and so many bounties. And we really don't perceive this land as our land. We perceive this land as its own entity, its own organism. And if we didn't share it, it just wouldn't feel right. And so it's a really inspiring place for community to come out and to gather. And we have everything from conferences to tours to field harvest days where we teach people how to butcher their animals. And we have a hunting program and on-site Airbnb, and really the goal is just to reform that intimacy with nature. Mm. And when people come out here, it's crazy, but sometimes it's people's first time to be out in the country. It's their first time to see a live animal. Their first time to visit a ranch in which they nourish their family from. And it closes that loop, and it has so much potential to change someone's trajectory in their life. I feel like in my younger days, and I had exposure to this, I certainly would have had an affinity for reorienting myself as a young man and finding a way to be more involved.
Yeah. How many people do you get to come out to the bison field harvest?
Those events are magical, and we sell each one of those out every year. It's really neat. We have people come from all over the country. Out of each event, we'll cap it around 30 people, and it's not uncommon for half of that crowd to fly in from another state.
I'm about ready.
it's an honor. There's a lot of pressure to make these events live up to the potential, but they're beautiful. I mean, we start out, get everyone oriented, tell them where they are, the intention of the day, and then we'll take everyone out into the herd in a big trailer, and our on-site ranch hand, James Tomney, will shoot an animal, and every time we have a list. And there'll be like 3 or 4 candidates on that list. And every time that one of those 4 or 5 bison will self-separate, it's like it's processed. It kind of knows that its energy is time to transform into something greater and to cycle back into its next phase. We harvest the animal, and it's just the most beautiful expression of nature that you have to see this to believe it. But there's a moment where every single bison in the herd will surround their down herd mate, and they touch it, and they put their nose on it, and they just sit in almost in this transitional meditative phase. They're seeing an expression and an expansion of energy that is very palpable, and they can perceive this soul or this light energy being emitted back into the ether. I mean, you're like peeking beneath the veil in real time and appreciating this cycle of life and this transfer of energy. And then we move the herd, and then everyone that comes to the event gets to get out and touch that animal and thank it and bless it. And we encourage people beforehand to write a letter to the bison. And some people will read their letter or sing a song or do a poem. It's just a beautiful end-of-life transition. Like, I couldn't imagine a better way to die with a group, a community that's just completely in admiration and gratitude for your being and your transitioning at your home, surrounded by your family. So I'm like in the mind of the bison now, like the place you were born, with your best friends and your family by your side, eating your favorite food, and then there's no pain. It's just the gunshot happens, and as soon as we can hear the gunshot, the animal, the sentience is lost. Mm. And so these are just amazing events, life-changing events, and then people get to butcher the animal. You teach them where their favorite cuts come from, and we get a little weird sometimes, and we'll eat some raw heart or some liver, and share in the bounties and talk about it. And it's as life-affirming for us as it is for everyone else to do that in a community setting.
Sure, yeah. I had this funny thought last night. I thought instead of telling people sweet dreams, which you might do it in the evening, I'm going to start doing that in the day. Rome Ranch is such a beautiful dream that you've brought into fruition that I think we need to start realizing that life is but a dream and we can create what we imagine or go after. And I'm wondering, what's been your biggest challenge with your Rome Ranch dream?
Yeah, I love that, the analogy with a dream. I don't know whose quote this is, but I've heard it before, that the only difference between a dream and in your reality is that in a dream, you never doubt yourself.
I love that too.
Which is like so beautiful. This dream that we're living and we're creating and manifesting, it certainly had hardship. I think anything that's worthwhile pursuing is challenging because you have to have the polarity. You have to have like the good and the bad and the hard and the easy to have a full spectrum appreciation of the experience and be present. And so for us, I'd say that some of the hardest experiences that we've had to go through is early on, we had two, and this was with poor management, you know, learning the animals, but we had two occasions where the animals got out. You know, even though we're in the country, we're kind of in this Texas wine corridor where it's like the Napa Valley is being built around us. And so having 150 bison vision questing on multi-million dollar vineyard crossing highways is scary and stressful. And I think that's certainly taken years of our life away the two times that has happened. But then the learning experience of that is, you know, just being humble enough to know that we're not in charge and then being more diligent about understanding the exact needs of the animals.
Yeah. So what's your favorite cut of bison meat?
Oh, gosh. If I have some friends over that have never had bison before, I'm going to keep it pretty basic, and I'm going to go tenderloin. I'm going to grill a whole tenderloin because it's just phenomenal. I mean, it's the best tasting. It's the bite is perfect, and it tastes as an expression of the landscape and the season. It captures it really nicely, and it's very pleasing, and all you need is sea salt. And so that's kind of my go-to if I'm going to just wow some first-time bison eaters. If I'm going to eat something, maybe just for my family, I keep it simple. I love grind, and I love elevating my grind. I'll mix in some liver and some heart and maybe some kidneys. And so I get like those nutrient dense, timeless organ cuts. And then I'll put them in a grind with muscle meat, and I'll do it at the right balance to where it's very easy to eat. It's very versatile, and it's not overwhelmingly organy. You know, we started selling that product. It's actually our most popular product we've ever made.
Wonderful.
We call it the Ancestral Blend.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Well, I can't help but imagine blue bonnets running through your property.
Oh, you know it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sight, those blue bonnets in the spring.
It's the best. So Lady Bird Johnson, she lived, as the crow flies, the Texas White House is like 4 miles from us. And Lady Bird Johnson's legacy project as the first lady was this re-beautification of America through wildflowers. And one of her just most beautiful quotes that I love reflecting on, she said, "Where wildflowers grow, so does hope." Mm. And I just think it's so perfect because wildflowers are the first thing that come up when land is degraded. So, yeah, you think about blue bonnets and all these amazing things, wine cups and Indian paintbrush and Indian blankets and, you know, like every color of the rainbow. And they're opportunistic healing plants. They come and they mine those minerals and they feed pollinators. And they're on purpose working to make the land better. And the crazy thing is that this little area of this hill country that we're in was historically a tiny little town called Blumenthal. And this area was settled by German immigrants in the early 1800s, and Blumenthal translated to something like Valley of Flowers. Mm. And it had been about 80 years since there was a wildflower in Blumenthal because of the conventional industrial farming that was happening here. And we have neighbors that are in their 80s that were born on this property that come out during wildflower season and tears are in their eyes and they're saying, "What is that plant? What is that blue plant? What about that pink one?" And they've never known what a wildflower was because in conventional industrial agriculture, they're just perceived as weeds, which technically they fall in the category or the family of weeds, which we can get into that. But that's just weeds are plants that we don't quite understand their purpose and role. And so we just demonize them as worthless. And so we just love this idea of bringing flowers back to Blumenthal, like pre-European industrialization and extraction of this landscape. What did it look like? And the wildflowers are certainly getting better and better every year.
Nice. Well, Taylor, thank you. You're helping to keep my dream alive. I am talking to regen folks all the time, and so it just makes me feel like, oh, it's everywhere, it's everything, even though it's such a small percentage at this point in time, but the boom is happening.
It's happening. You're right. No, I feel it too. The change that's happened in 8 years has been incredible, not only on this ranch, but globally.
Yeah.
And one of our legacy goals at Epic when we started was, what if we could contribute to 1 million acres of land being transitioned to regenerative management? And it happened.
Yeah.
It happened in 4 years. And with our new company, Force of Nature, reimagining that legacy goal, and we're saying, what if we can convert 1 billion acres globally?
Well, I'm with you.
That's where we're headed. I mean, it's the only path forward.
Yes.
And it's one of hope, and it's one that gets people back on land and celebrates the community, puts culture back in agriculture. I just am over the moon. I think it's the greatest. So we're blessed to be doing this.
Carla, it appears your education and career is centered around environmental studies and engineering, and you consult on environmental and agricultural projects for both governments and for farmers. What drew you to Elaine Ingham's work, and what piece does her soil food web hold in moving into a regenerative role in agriculture?
Thank you for the question. And this is a question that we can stay talking forever.
Right.
I'll try to be summarized as I can. My background is in biology. So it's natural for me to just look for answers in nature, right? That whole concept of bringing back to common knowledge that human being is just another animal in this whole planet food web.
Yes.
Over my career, this was always what drove me, is just how can we reconnect with nature? Of course, at our time, we had the huge challenge of never seeing so many people on the planet at the same time, the logistic of producing food, delivering food for everyone in the time that needs to be there. those challenges were never seen before. So those adjustments are needed. And this is where I think that the engineering portion of my career helps me to understand a tiny bit, because we're always just scratching the surface, which I really love to work in an interdisciplinary team.
Yeah.
And over my PhD, which I was at Oregon State University, where Dr. Lane was also professor. Unfortunately, when I joined the program, she was not there anymore. But I start to find more pieces to connect with her career. And hearing her was just like, oh my gosh, this woman is the missing puzzle that I need. Because she can just translate any intricate piece of information in a way that anyone, literally anyone, can digest. One day, it was really by accident. I was just perusing the library board, and I saw one that the Soil Food Web School was looking for part-time folks. And I just like, you know what? This kind of makes sense. But had no, her name was not there. And
oh,
when
my
I
gosh.
Just like, oh, we just fill this position, but we love your resume. Are you up to have an interview with Dr. Elaine? And after a minute of pause, of out of shock, it's just like, yeah, just to meet her is a huge honor. And five, almost 6 years in the future, here I am having the happiness of living in the same city as hers for 5.5 years. So drinking from the source. She's the missing based on this big puzzle of how can we translate all the knowledge academia and private research sector is doing on a way that any person, not just consultants, but farmers also can understand and apply in the field. Because I believe this is the only way that we can really be able to put the regen ag in a level that we can really transition all the land on this planet without having to reduce the amount of food we need to produce.
That is an important piece in itself, isn't it? Getting the research into the land, into the hands of the farmers, being able to use this information without being a PhD or having spent 5 years in a lab, right? So many farmers, here they are, they've spent their entire lives on the land. So am I correct in thinking that the soil food web is a three-step approach for rejuvenating the soil? Can it be broken down into three steps?
Generally speaking, yes. And of course, that when you go to the field, you start to doing things, you have a lot of details on these three major steps. But just to give you a bit more of information here, the school, we divide the consultants program in three stages. And this is pretty much how a consultant will work with any farmer. And when a farmer take our course, it's pretty much how they're going to do in their own property as well.
Yes.
So on stage one, we're going to talk about how to make the best biological compost as possible. This is the basics of everything. It's where we're going to bring all the biology to that small amount of organic material and then transfer that to the soil. Once you master this ability to make thermophilic compost, you move to the liquid amendments. How you're going to extract that biology into a liquid form so you can use all the equipment and machinery you already have in your farm. You don't need to buy anything else, and apply that in your soil. The stage three, which as a farmer you're going to do, is that at the same time you are making the liquids and applying, you're going to monitor that in the soil. How much biology from my application is surviving, how frequent needs to be those applications, what do I need to adjust each round of application? And for that, we need the microscopy on our side, which we also train everyone on stage one, right? You need to know how to identify those biology and quantify them to be able to, on a fast check during the applications in the field, yes, I'm on the right track. No, I need to intensify. No, I can space out. The system is dynamic. We cannot lose track of this. We need to be constantly checking to adapt the actions as you go. And in my perspective, this is the major game changer when we are talking about regenerative agriculture. Change the mindset to understand that any biological system is dynamic, is in constant change. So if we don't learn how to read the messages they're sending us, we're going to struggle. So the huge portion of the learning process is how to read the signals that Mother Nature is telling us, like Elaine says. I love this sentence because it summarizes huge portion of her teaching.
So what is the test? Is there one soil test you use?
Yeah, beautiful. That's a very important question, which allows me to increase a bit more of details on the previous answer. When I talked about liquid amendments, I'm talking about the extracts and teas made from the thermophilic compost, the biologically or biocomplete active compost that Elaine teaches how to do it. Before I start any application from any methods from Dr. Elaine, we're going to do a sample collection, a soil sample collection, and we're going to take those sample to the microscope. We're going to dilute in water, build up one slide, take to the microscope, and do what we call biological assessment of the sample. There, I will quantify the major groups that we count under Dr. Elaine program, which is the bacterial biomass, fungal biomass, the beneficial protozoa, beneficial nematodes, the low oxygen or like anaerobic organisms, which have some group of fungi, some actinomycetes can be also not so good, and ciliates are indicators of lower oxygen condition. They are not bad. They just indicate that we need to increase aeration in our system so our aerobic organisms can thrive.
Yes.
And this is simple microscope assessment to check the microorganisms. With this raw number, we're going to run on the school SMAP software, which will give us the range we have in our sample. And that is our point zero of assessment. I know what I have and what I don't have in soil. Based on that, I can select which of my compost pile is the best one to be able to make the best extract and the best tea from that compost to deliver the missing organisms in my soil on that period of time. So 14 days after the application, I will collect another soil sample, run another microscopy test, and check how the biology is developing. Do I see any change? Yes, but the numbers are not there yet. Repeat the same process. No change at all. What I need to do? I need to investigate, but high chances just double up the amount of amendments you're applying, in this case, the extracts and teas, or apply more often instead of once 2 weeks, once a week, maybe even twice a week. Depend a lot on your initial condition, where you are, the need of your plant. And sometimes, if you notice that there is a lot of incidence of pathogens or the plants are so showing a lot of sign of heavy diseases, in this case, you can check for chemicals in the soil, like chemistry analysis, because might be lack of some heavy nutrient or could be contamination from some sort. Even if you want, it's more expensive, but now it's getting somewhere a bit easier to afford that is the genetic testing. They don't quantify, but they're going to give a list of microorganisms there. Is there. Those that are aerobic and no disease and causers, it's good. You already have a good idea. If you have the pathogens or disease causers, then you can decide to come with biological control because you're not going to kill the good biology you're already putting in the soil. And give another boost of your good guys that you have, the good biology you have in your compost. So summarizing, the microscopy testing that Dr. Lane teaches is the best one. It's cheap, fast, and you can do it, or you can get one of our lab techs to do it for you. And if you see any signs of things are not turning good, even though after many applications of the good biology, I would look for chemistry and genetic testing.
When you want to go after the biology and really unleash the biology, is that a fungal issue, do you think? Is that what help can build the aggregates in the soil?
Yeah, that's, again, another beautiful question. I love that a lot. And Dr. Lane works that concept very intrinsically on her basic courses, the foundation courses. But in summary, let's say even if an area that was never treated chemically, no chemical fertilizers, nothing like that, you're going to have a lot of nutrients contained, stored in the parent material, in the rock material. So what the biology does, what the soil food web does, is exactly that. And it starts with bacteria and fungi. They will break down all those parent material that's there as they die or as they're chewed up by protozoa, by nematodes, or microorganisms. They will release those nutrients that, chemically speaking, all that happens inside the bacteria and fungi body is that they convert this mineral that's on a form the plant cannot absorb on a format that the plants can easily absorb. First, when the bacteria and fungi dies by natural death or digested, those minerals will be released to the system through the poop loop that when they're being recycled, then the plant can absorb those nutrients. That's one path. Another path that is recently beautifully described by Dr. White is that we have one system called rhizophagy, the symbiosis between the root system and the microorganisms. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. And again, it's another 2 hours lecture that we can easily see here. But essentially, the root system, we're going to release the exudates to call out bacteria and some small protozoa closer to the system. Once they get there, they open up pores in the root system. Those microorganisms are going to enter the root system. They close up and the root digests those microorganisms inside, releasing all the nutrients the plant requires. If we just take a quick look on all the research that's been developed and published around the globe, the common sense is that the food web is the best and fast way to release nutrients to the system. And easily you can confirm that if you go to any native as possible forested system, it sustains itself. No one is there adding fertilizer, right, adding anything. It's just letting all the food web below ground and above ground doing the work to recycle the nutrients.
Well, two things about Elaine's work and your work and testing. What would the farmer need to do this testing? Beside water, you mentioned their own soil, their own dirt.
Yeah. Yes, they need the soil sample. They want to test the water, some basic material to use with the microscope, like cover slip, slides, some test tubes. This is the kind of thing that you cannot substitute, like a test tube holder. Just get a piece of wood, do some holes, and you have a beautiful homemade one.
It sounds like the farmer's way.
Yes, exactly. And I love that. I see so many good adaptations that is just like, yes, thank you. You made my day. And the microscope is another piece you cannot replace. But you can start with a simple one that can range on about $200, $500. You have a beautiful microscope. It needs to be biological compound microscope. The AB condenser needs to be 1.25. And you need to have the objectives of 4 times, 10 times, and 40 times a magnification. So those are the basics of microscope recommendation we are looking for. And there is many different brands in the market, but I would encourage you to start with a basic one. And once you enroll for the courses, they give you a list of many different types of the microscope. And you can always reach out to the school with more questions on that realm if you need.
Would you say that the eventual goal would be for the land to be its own closed loop system?
Yes, exactly. Yes, some people just ask, but I'm going to hire a consultant to get rid of the consultant. Yes, that's the deal, right? In one point, it's not that you're going to get rid of the consultant, but it will demand less intensive management, right? In the beginning, it's like a transition plan. You need to allow the system to understand that we are changing the rules here. You're not going to get the food delivered directly to your door. You're going to need to work a little bit. Send me the message. What do you need? I'm delivering everything here, but you need to work a little bit to get what you need. So in time, this means that you're going to find the sweet spot of the applications for your property, depending on the time of the year, on the crop. So each new crop, you're going to have the area, you're going to have this transition period that, depending on how restored the soil is, this transition period will be shorter because the biology is already there, so the system naturally speeds up. But what we cannot forget is that any agricultural system implies that we are constantly forcing the successional ecological movement to stay still in one place. So after a while, the system is going to start to fight against you. I need to move on. I need to move on. I have all the biology here. I need to move on. So this is when the work of the consultant will change a little bit on understanding how we're going to stabilize the biology and stay on this spot that I need. So in time, you need less and less amendments. You go just for the maintenance stage, unless the climate change more things that we are not aware yet.
Right, yes, as you said, it's constantly changing. Can you give us an example of someone you've worked with and what could happen in one or two growing seasons?
Yeah. One of my current students, she's doing the recovery on her backyard. And in her city, they had a very heavy chemical contamination in the soil, so the water is pretty much like rot. And she's using rainwater to give the chance to her area. And in 1 year, she more than doubled the organic matter level in her soil. So it's
Amazing.
feasible. It's a lot of work, I'm not gonna lie.
What is your experience with how the regenerative movement is happening in Brazil?
The school has the foundation courses translated in Portuguese, which I had the honor to also help them. And we have some students from Brazil in the school taking the courses. Brazil has a very deep research net, especially in ag, and there is a huge net of research going on. And like US, Brazil also has people going out and spread, but no one like Elaine. Elaine really open up all the black boxes and make that knowledgeable accessible to anyone. They're testing a lot, and this is one thing the school recommends as well, testing how the soil food web technique merges with other techniques, because then you're gonna have multiple tools in your toolbox, right? It's always test to see how it's going. I think that's one of the major cards that any Regen Ag project should have, is working teams, really brainstorm the actions, because each person is going to bring a different perspective and the results are going to be much better and the whole team will benefit. I think that this is how the Regen Ag is really mimicking nature. Each one is bringing their own little piece. And it's how we're going to be strong enough to face the big ag companies. They already saw that Regen Ag is there is no turning point, is the way to go, because they're starting to use the terminologies we use. So we have to stick together, otherwise they're going to engulf us. What I love the most about Regen Ag is that we can empower the small and medium farmers again. And this is global wise, right? Because US is one of the few privileged countries that small and medium and large farmers have some support from government. But unfortunately for the majority of the planet, this is not. The Regen Ag gives them this power and this freedom, which in my perspective, this is the only way to go. It's the only way that we can really make the change we need for the planet.
Amazing. There's always such great information to share. So thank you to Dr. Carla Portugal and to Taylor Collins. We can be found at cultivatedaudio.com and on your favorite podcast platforms. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.